The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, continued. Cassette 7, Side 1. In the central sector of Burepolom camp, in the barracks housing the last leggers, in February 1943, out of 50 people, there were never fewer than 4 deaths a night, and one night there were 12. In the morning, their places were taken by new last leggers who dreamed of recuperating on a diet of thin magara gruel and 14 ounces of bread. Corpses, withered from pellagra, no buttocks, and women with no breasts, or rotting from scurvy, were checked out in the morgue cabin and sometimes in the open air. This was seldom like an autopsy, a long vertical cut from neck to crotch, breaking leg bones, pulling the skull apart at its seam. Mostly it was not a surgeon, but a convoy guard who verified the corpse, to be certain the Zek was really dead and not pretending. And for this they ran the corpse through with a bayonet or smashed the skull with a big mallet. And right there they tied to the big toe of the corpse's right foot a tag with his prison file number, under which he was identified in the prison lists. At one time they used to bury them in their underwear, but later on in the very worst, lowest grade, which was dirty grey. And then came an across-the-board regulation not to waste any underwear on them at all. It could still be used for the living, but to bury them naked. At one time in old Russia it was thought that a corpse could not get along without a coffin. Even the lowliest serfs, beggars, and tramps were buried in coffins. Even the Sakhalin and the Akachui hard labor prisoners were buried in coffins. But in the archipelago, this would have amounted to the unproductive expenditure of millions on labor and lumber. When at Inta, after the war, one honored foreman of the woodworking plant was actually buried in a coffin, the cultural and educational section was instructed to make propaganda. "Work well! And you, too, will be buried in a wooden coffin." The corpses were hauled away on sledges or on carts, depending on the time of year. Sometimes, for convenience, they used one box for 6 corpses. And if there were no boxes, then they tied the hands and legs with cords so they didn't flop about. After this, they piled them up like logs and covered them with bast matting. If there was ammonal available, a special brigade of grave diggers would dynamite pits for them. Otherwise, they had to dig the graves, always common graves, in the ground, either big ones for a large number, or shallow ones for 4 at a time. In the springtime, a stink used to waft into the camp from the shallower graves, and they would then send last leggers to deepen them. On the other hand, no one can accuse us of gas chambers. Where there was more time to spare on such things, as, for example, in Kengir, they would set out little posts on the hillocks, and a representative of the records and classification section, no less, would personally inscribe on them the inventory numbers of those buried there. However, in Kengir, someone also did some wrecking. Mothers and wives who came there were shown the cemetery, and they went there to mourn and weep. Thereupon the chief of Steplag, Comrade Colonel Chechev, ordered the bulldozers to bulldoze down the little grave posts and level off the hillocks, because of this lack of gratitude. Now that, fair reader, is how your father, your husband, your brother was buried. And that is how the path of the native and his way of life come to an end. But as a matter of fact, it was Pavel Bykov who said, "Until 24 hours have passed after death, don't be so sure that it's all over." Well, Ivan Denisovich, what is there left that we haven't yet recounted from the routine of our daily lives? Ooh, you haven't even begun. It would take as many years as you served to tell it all, like about the Zek who broke formation to chase a cigarette butt and the convoy guard shot him. In Dostoevsky's time, a prisoner could leave formation to beg alms, and in formation the prisoners used to chat and sing. How the invalid Zeks in the kitchen gulped down raw potatoes. Once cooked, they'd not get any. How tea was used in place of money in camps. How they used to brew up a super-strong tea mix, 1 3/4 ounces to a glass, and get a high. But that was mostly the thieves, They used to buy tea from the free employees with stolen money. And how did Ezek manage to live on the whole, if he couldn't manage to weave string from sand, if he wasn't both tight-fisted and ingenious? He couldn't survive. Even in his sleep, the Zek had to keep thinking how to dodge and twist his way through the next day. And if you've got your hands on something or sniffed out some loophole, then keep your mouth shut. Keep it shut, or else the guys next to you would find out and mess it all up. That's how it is in camp. There just isn't enough for everyone anyway, so see to it there's enough for you. Well, that's as may be, but still, even in camp you have the old human custom of making friends. Not only old friendships, co-defendants or comrades from out in freedom, but new ones made here. People's hearts went out to each other, and they confided in each other. Buddies. Whatever we have, we share, and whatever we don't, 50-50. It's true that we keep our precious bread rations separate, but everything gotten hold of otherwise is cooked in one mess tin and ladled from the same one. For some reason, in the hard labor regime described by Dostoevsky, friendship did not flourish, and no one paired off even to eat. There were buddies who stayed together a short time, and others who stayed together a long time. Some pairings were based on conscience, and others on deceit. Like a snake, the godfather used to like to crawl in between such friendships. Over a common mess tin and in a whisper, you'd talk about everything. The old Zeks admit, and the former POWs will tell you too, the one who sells you down the river is the one who ate from the mess tin with you. And that's also a partial truth. But the best deal is not to have a buddy, but a girl buddy, a camp wife, a Zechka. As they used to say, to get sub-married. What was good if you were young was to her somewhere in a one-night shack-up, and that would do your soul good. And even for an old weak guy, it was still good. You could get something anyway, earn a favor, maybe she would do your washing for you, bring it to your barracks, put your shirt under your pillow, and no one would laugh. It was in the law. She would cook for you, too. You would sit down on your cot next to each other and eat. And that kind of camp espousal would suit even an old chap particularly well, just barely warm with a little touch of bitter flavor. You'd look at her through the steam from the mess pot, and there were wrinkles on her face, yes, and on your own, too. You were both in gray camp rags, your padded jackets were all stained with rust and clay and lime and alabaster and lubricating grease. You never knew her before, and you'd never set foot on her native soil, and she didn't talk like one of ours either. And out in freedom, her children were growing up, and yours, too. And she had left her husband there, too, who was skirt-chasing. And your own wife had been left alone, too, and she wasn't letting the grass grow under her feet, either. After all, 8 years, 10 years, everyone wants to live. And this, your camp wife, drags the same chain as you do and doesn't complain. And we live, not like people. And we die, not like parents. Some Zeks got visits from their real wives. In various camps under various chiefs, they were allowed to sit together for 20 minutes in the gatehouse. And there were even cases where they spent a night or two together in a separate shack, if you were 150%er. But these visits were nothing more than poison. Why touch her with your hands and talk with her about something if you still had years and years to go before living with her again? It split the men in two. With a camp wife, everything is clearer. Between us, we have one cup of grits left. They say we're going to get burnt sugar this coming week. It won't be white, of course. The rats. Lathe operator Rodichev's wife came to visit him, and just before she arrived, his shack-up bit him on the neck while making love. Rodichev swore a blue streak because his wife was coming, and off he went to the medical section to get a bandage put on his bruise. I can say I caught cold. And what kind of women were there in camp? There were women thieves, and there were loose women, and there were politicals. But most of all, there were lowly and humble women sent there under the decree. They were all sent up under the decree for theft of state property. During and after the war, who crowded all the factories full? Women and girls. And who had to feed the family? They. And what were they to feed the family with? Need knows no law. And so they would pilfer. They used to put sour cream in their pockets, sneak out rolls between their legs, wine stockings around their waists, and the likeliest way was to go to work barefoot and grab new stockings there at work, put them on and wash them at home and take them to the open market to sell. Whoever produced something would swipe that. They would stick a spool of thread between their breasts. All the watchmen had been bribed, for they had to live too, and they only picked off the few, hit or miss. And then the guard would jump in and there would be a body search, and it was 10 years for that shitty spool, the same as for treason. And thousands got caught with those spools. Everyone was on the take to the extent that her work permitted it. Nastya Gurginka had it good. She used to work in the baggage cars, and she reasoned things out quite correctly. Our own Soviet people are persistent bastards, and they'll jump at your throat just for a lousy towel. Therefore, she never touched Soviet suitcases and cleaned out only foreigners. The foreigner, she said, wouldn't even think to check up on his things in time, and by the time he found out about it, he wouldn't bother to write a complaint, and all he would do was spit out, "Russian thieves," and he would go back to his own country. Shitarev, an old bookkeeper, used to reproach Nastya. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself. You're just a piece of meat. Why didn't you think about the honor of Russia?" And she would tell him off. "Up yours and stand still for it, too. Why didn't you worry about victory? You used to let all those gentlemen officers go home to play stud dog." Shitarev had been a hospital bookkeeper during the war, and the officers used to grease his palms so that he would extend their period of sick leave by forging their travel documents, and they could go home before returning to the front. This was very serious. Shitarev had been sentenced to be shot, and only later was his sentence commuted to a tenor. Of course, there were all kinds of unfortunate serving time as well. One woman got a fiver for fraud. Her husband had died in the middle of the month, and she went on collecting his bread rations till the end of the month without turning the card in, using it for herself and for her two children. Her neighbours informed on her out of jealousy. She served 4 years too, and 1 year was knocked off by the amnesty. And this could happen too. A house was bombed out, the wife and children were killed, and the husband was left. All the ration cards were burned, but the husband was out of his mind and lived through the whole 13 days until the end of the month without bread rations, and did not ask for a ration card for himself. Therefore, they suspected that all his ration cards were intact. They gave him 3 years, and he served 1.5 of the 3. Now, just a minute there, just a minute, Ivan Denisich. That's all for another time. And so you are telling us about a girl buddy, right? About sub-marriage. She drags the same chain you do, and doesn't complain? Chapter 8. Women in Camp. And how could one not think of them, even back during interrogation? After all, they were somewhere here in neighbouring cells, in this very same prison, under this very same regimen, enduring this unbearable interrogation. And how could they bear it, such weak beings? The corridors were soundless, and you could not distinguish their walk or the rustle of their dresses. But one day, one of the Butyrki jailers was fussing with a lock, and left our men's cell to stand 30 minutes at the windows in the well-lit upper corridor, and peering underneath the muzzle of a corridor window, we suddenly saw down below, in the little green garden on a corner of asphalt, standing in line in pairs like us, and also waiting for a door to be opened, women's shoes and ankles. All we could see were just ankles and shoes, but on high heels. And it was like a Wagnerian blast from Tristan and Isolde. We could see no higher than that, and the jailer was already driving us into the cell. And once inside, we raved there, illumined and at the same time beclouded. And we pictured all the rest to ourselves, imagining them as heavenly beings dying of despondency. What were they like? What were they like? But it seems that things were no harder for them, and maybe even easier. I have so far found nothing in women's recollections of interrogation which could lead me to conclude that they were any more disheartened than we were, or that they became any more deeply depressed. The gynecologist, N.I. Zubov, who served 10 years himself, and who in camp was constantly engaged in treating and observing women, says, to be sure, that statistically women react more swiftly and more sharply to arrest than men, and to its principal effect, the loss of the family. The woman arrested is spiritually wounded, and this expresses itself most often in the cessation of the vulnerable female functions. But what particularly surprised me in the women's recollections of interrogation was what trifles, from a prisoner's point of view, but not at all from a woman's, they could be thinking about there. Nadya Surovtseva, pretty and still young, hastily pulled on stockings that didn't match to go to her interrogation, and there in the interrogator's office she was embarrassed because the interrogator kept looking at her legs. You would think she should be saying, "The hell with him! Horseradish on his snoot!" It wasn't as if she were going to the theatre with him, and besides, she was almost a doctor of philosophy, in the Western sense, and a fervid political partisan, so who would have thought it? And Alexandra Ostretseva, imprisoned in the Big Lubyanka in 1943, told me later on in camp that they used to kid around in there. They would hide under the table, and the scared jailer would come in to look for the one who was missing. Or they would paint themselves red with beet juice and go out like that for their walk. Or, already summoned to interrogation, she would have an animated discussion with her cellmates, whether she should dress simply that day or put on her evening dress. True, Ostretseva was at that time a spoiled, naughty young girl, and was imprisoned with young Mira Uborovich. But another prisoner, N.I.P. blank V.A., older and a scientist, used to sharpen her aluminum spoon in her cell. And why do you think? To cut her throat? No, to cut off her braids. And she did cut them off. Subsequently, in the yard at Krasnaya Preznya, I happened to be next to a prisoner transport of women who, like us, had been recently sentenced. And with astonishment I saw that they were not so thin, not so emaciated and pale as we were. Equal prison rations for all and equal prison torments turn out on the average to be easier for women. They do not weaken so quickly from hunger. But of course for all of us, and for women in particular, prison was just the flower. The berries came later, camp. And it was precisely in camp that the women would either be broken or else, by bending and degenerating, adapt themselves. In camp, it was the opposite. Everything was harder for the women than for us men, beginning with the camp filth. Having already suffered from the dirt in the transit prisons and on the prisoner transports themselves, the woman would then find no cleanliness in camp either. In the average camp, in the women's work brigades, and also, it goes without saying, in the common barracks, it was almost never possible for her to feel really clean, to get warm water. And sometimes there was no water at all. In winter, at Krivoshchevkovo camp number 1, it was impossible to wash anywhere in the whole place. The only water was frozen, and there was nowhere to thaw it. There was no lawful way a woman could lay her hands on either cheesecloth or rags. No place there, of course, to do laundry. A bath? Well, the initial arrival in camp began with a bath, if one doesn't take into account the unloading of the zeks from the cattle car onto the snow, and the march across with one's things on one's back, surrounded by convoy and dogs. In the camp bath, the naked women were examined like merchandise. Whether there was water in the bath or not, the inspection for lice, the shaving of armpits and pubic hair, gave the barbers, by no means the lowest-ranking aristocrats in the camp, the opportunity to look over the new women. And immediately after that, they would be inspected by the other trustees. This was a tradition going right back to the Solovetsky Islands, except that there, at the dawn of the archipelago, a shyness still existed, not typical of the natives, and they were inspected clothed during auxiliary work. But the archipelago hardened, and the procedure became more brazen. Fedot S. and his wife, it was their fate to be united, now recollect with amusement how the male trustees stood on either side of a narrow corridor and passed the newly arrived women through the corridor naked, not all at once, but one at a time. And then the trustees decided among themselves who got whom. According to the statistics of the 20s, there was one woman serving time for every 6 or 7 men. After the decrees of the 30s and 40s, the proportion of women to men rose substantially, but still not sufficiently for women not to be valued, particularly the attractive ones. In certain camps, a polite procedure was preserved. The women were conducted to their barracks, and then the well-fed, self-confident, and impudent trustees entered the barracks, dressed in new padded jackets. Any clothing in camp which was not in tatters and soiled seemed mad foppery. Slowly and deliberately they strolled between the bunks and made their choices. They sat down and chatted. They invited their choices to visit them. And they were living, too, not in a common barracks situation, but in cabins occupied by several men. And there they had hot plates and frying pans. And they had fried potatoes, too. An unbelievable dream. The first time, the chosen women were simply feasted and given the chance to make comparisons and to discover the whole spectrum of camp life. Impatient trustees demanded payment right after the potatoes, while those more restrained escorted their dates home and explained the future. "You'd better make your arrangements. Make your arrangements inside the camp compound, darling, while it is being proposed in a gentlemanly way. There's cleanliness here, and laundry facilities, and decent clothes, and unfatiguing work. And it's all yours." And in this sense, it is considered to have been easier for women in camp. It was easier for women to preserve life itself. And with that sexual hatred with which certain of the last leggers looked on those women in camp who had not descended to pickings from the slops, it was natural to reason that it was easier for women in camp, since they could get along on a lesser ration and had a way to avoid starvation and remain alive. For the man, crazed by hunger, the entire world is overshadowed by the wings of hunger, and nothing else in the world is of any importance. And it is true, there are women who, by their own nature, out in freedom too, by and large, get together with men easily without being choosy. Such women, of course, always had open to them easy ways out. Personal characteristics do not get distributed simply on the basis of the articles of the criminal code. Yet we are not likely to be in error if we say that the majority of women among the 58s were not of this kind. For some of them, from the beginning to the end, this step was less bearable than death. Others would bridle, hesitate, be embarrassed, and they were held back by shame before their girlfriends, too. And when they had finally decided, when they had reconciled themselves, it might be too late. They might not find a camp taker any longer, because not every one was lucky enough to get propositioned. Thus, many of them gave in during the first few days. The future looked too cruel, and there was no hope at all. And this choice was made by those who were almost little girls, along with solidly married women and mothers of families. And it was the little girls in particular, stifled by the crudity of camp life, who quickly became the most reckless of all. "What if you said no? All right, that's your lookout. Put on breeches and pea jacket, and go marching off to the woods with your formless, fat exterior and your frail inner being. You'll come crawling yet. You'll go down on bended knees. If you have arrived in camp in good physical shape, and if you have made a wise decision at the very beginning, then you're all set for a long stay in the medical section, in the kitchen, in the bookkeeping office, in the sewing shop or in the laundry, and the years will flow past comfortably enough, quite like out in freedom. And if a prisoner transport comes your way, you will arrive in your new place, too, in full flower, and you will already know how to act there from the very start. One of the most successful moves you can make is to become a servant to one of the chiefs. When I.N. arrived in camp on a new prisoner transport, she was a portly, well-preserved woman who for many years had been the prosperous wife of a high army commander. The chief of the records and classification section immediately spotted her and gave her the post of honor of washing floors in the chief's office. And that is how she began serving out her term in a soft spot, fully aware that this was a piece of luck. And what of it if you loved someone out in freedom and wanted to remain true to him? What profit is there in the fidelity of a female corpse? When you get back to freedom, who is going to need you? Those were the words which kept ringing eternally through the women's barracks. You grow coarse and old, and your last years as a woman are cheerless and empty. Isn't it smarter to hurry up and grab something, too, even from this savage life? And it was all made easier by the fact that no one here condemned anyone else. Everyone lives like that here. And hands were also untied by the fact that there was no meaning, no purpose left in life. Those who did not give in right off either changed their minds or else were compelled to anyway. And even the most stubborn of all, if she was good-looking, would give in, and go to bed under duress. Give in. In our mini-camp at the Kaluga gates in Moscow, there was a proud wench, M, a former lieutenant and a sniper. She was like a princess in a fairy tale, crimson lips, the bearing of a swan, jet-black locks. In my play, I portrayed her under the name Granya Zibina, but there I endowed her with a better fate than the one she actually had. And the fat, dirty old stock clerk, Isaac Bershada, decided to buy her. He was nauseating in appearance, and to her, in view of her own resilient beauty, her own recent heroic life, he was particularly repulsive. He was a rotten snag, and she was a tall, beautiful poplar. But he besieged her so persistently and hard she could hardly breathe. He not only condemned her to general work, all the trustees acted in concert and helped him in his entrapment. She was subjected to harassment by the jailers. He also had the jailers on his hook. And he even threatened her with an assuredly bad prisoner transport to far away. And one evening, when the lights had gone out in the camp, I myself saw how, in a twilight pale because of snow and sky, M went like a shadow from the women's barracks and knocked with bent head at this greedy Bershada's storeroom. After that, she was well taken care of inside the camp compound. M.N., who was already middle-aged and a draftsman out in freedom, the mother of two children, who had lost her husband in prison, had already gone far along the path of a last legger and the women's logging brigade, and still kept on being stubborn, and was close to the point of no return. Her legs swelled up. She stumbled back from work at the tail end of the column, and the convoy would drive her along with blows of their gun stocks. One day she somehow stayed behind in the compound. The cook played up to her. "Come on, over to my cabin. I will feed you a bellyful." She went. He put a big frying pan of fried potatoes and pork in front of her. She ate it all up, but after she had paid for it, she threw up, and the potatoes were all lost. The cook swore at her, "Just think, what a princess!" And from then on she got used to it gradually. She got in a better position, and later, sitting at a camp film showing, she would pick out a man for the night. And anyone who went on waiting longer would have to drag herself to the men's common barracks on her own, not to the trustees by this time, and walk down the aisles between the bunks repeating monotonously, "Half a kilo, half a kilo." And if a rescuer would go with her for a bread ration, then she would curtain off her bunk with sheets on three sides, and in this tent, this shack, hence shack up, earn her bread, if the jailer didn't catch her first. A multiple bunk, curtained off with rags from the neighbouring women, was a classic camp scene. But things could be a great deal simpler than that, too. This again refers to the Krivoshchekovo camp, number 1, 1947 to 1949. We know of this number 1, but how many were there? At this camp there were thieves, non-political offenders, juveniles, invalids, women and nursing mothers, all mixed up together. There was just one women's barracks, but it held 500 people. It was indescribably filthy, incomparably filthy and run down, and there was an oppressive smell in it, and the bunks were without bedding. There was an official prohibition against men entering it, but this prohibition was ignored and no one enforced it. Not only men went there, but juveniles too, boys from 12 to 13, who flocked in to learn. First, they began with simple observation of what was going on. There was no false modesty there, whether because there were no rags or perhaps not enough time. At any rate, the bunks were not curtained off. And, of course, the light was never doused either. Everything took place very naturally, as in nature, in full view, and in several places at once. Obvious old age and obvious ugliness were the only defences for a woman there, nothing else. Attractiveness was a curse. Such a woman had a constant stream of visitors on her bunk and was constantly surrounded. They propositioned her and threatened her with beatings and knives, and she had no hope of being able to stand up against it, but only to be smart about whom she gave in to pick the kind of man to defend her with his name and his knife from all the rest, from the next in line, from the whole greedy queue, from those crazy juveniles gone berserk, aroused by everything they could see and breathe in there. And it wasn't only men that she had to be defended against either, nor only the juveniles who were aroused. What about the women next to them, who day after day had to see all that but were not themselves invited by the men? In the end, those women too would explode in an uncontrollable rage and hurl themselves on their successful neighbours and beat them up. And then, too, venereal diseases were nearly epidemic at Krivoshchekovo. There was a rumour that nearly half the women were infected, but there was no way out. And on, both the sovereigns and the suppliants kept crossing the same threshold. And only those who were very foresighted, like the accordionist K, who had his own connections in the medical section, could each time check the secret list of the venereal disease patients for himself and his friends, in order not to get caught. And what about the women in the Kolyma? After all, women were extremely rare there, and in desperate demand. It was better for a woman not to get caught on the work sites there, by a convoy guard, a free employee, or a prisoner. The Kolyma was where the expression streetcar for a gang rape arose. K.O. tells how a truck driver lost at cards a whole truckload of women, including K.O. herself being transported to Elgin. And, turning off the road, he delivered them for the night to a gang of unconvoyed construction workers. And what about the work? In any mixed brigade, there was some kind of indulgence for a woman, some kind of work which was a bit easier. But if the entire brigade consisted of women, then there was no mercy shown. Then they demanded the same cubic yards. And there were camps populated entirely by women, and in such camps the women were lumberjacks and ditch diggers and adobe bricklayers. And it was only to the copper and tungsten mines that women were not assigned. Take Karlag, Camp 29. How many women were there at that point? No more, no less than 6,000. This is relevant to the question of the total number of Zeks in the archipelago who knew this Camp 29, and was it the last one in Karlag? And how many people were there in each of the remaining camps? Anyone with the time to spare can multiply it for himself. And who knew a certain fifth construction sector of the Rybinsk Hydro project? In fact, there were more than 100 barracks there, and given even the least possible crowding, a good 6,000 were to be found there, too. Loschilin recollects that there were more than 10,000. What kind of work did these women do? Yelena O. worked as a loader. She used to haul bags weighing 175 to 200 pounds each. True, she was given help in getting them up on her shoulders, yes, and in her youth she had been a gymnast, too. Yelena Prokofievna Cheporeyeva worked as a loader throughout her 10-year sentence. At the women's camps, the established pattern of conduct was generally unfeminine and cruel, incessant cursing, incessant fights, misbehavior. Otherwise, you'd not survive. But as the unconvoyed engineer Prokhorov Pustover reports, women taken from a women's unit such as that and assigned as servants or to decent work immediately changed into quiet and hard-working women. He had occasion to observe such units in the 30s on the Baikal-Amur main line, working on second tracking the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Here is a picture. On a hot day, 300 women asked the convoy to permit them to bathe in a flooded ravine. The convoy refused permission. At that point, the women undressed to their bare skins and lay down to sun themselves, right along the railroad track in sight of all the passing trains. While local trains carrying Soviet citizens were passing by, this was no disaster, but they were expecting the International Express, in which there were foreigners. The women refused to obey orders to put their clothes on. So then the authorities summoned the local fire department and frightened them off with hoses. Here is what women's work was like in Krivoshchekovo. At the brickyard, when they had completed working one section of the clay pit, they used to take down the overhead shelter before they had mined there that had been laid out on the surface of the earth. And now it was necessary to hoist wet beams 10 to 12 yards up out of a big pit. How was it done? The reader will say, with machines, of course. A women's brigade looped a cable around each end of a beam, and in two rows, like barge haulers, keeping even so as not to let the beam drop and then have to begin over again, pulled one side of each cable and out came the beam. And then a score of them would hoist up one beam on their shoulders to the accompaniment of command oaths from their out-and-out slave driver of a woman brigadier, and would carry the beam to its new place and dump it there. A tractor, did you say? But for pity's sakes, where would you get a tractor in 1948? A crane, you say? But you have forgotten Vyshinsky. Work, the miracle worker which transforms people from non-existence and insignificance into heroes. If there were a crane, then what about the miracle worker? If there were a crane, then these women would simply wallow in insignificance. The body becomes worn out at that kind of work, and everything that is feminine in a woman, whether it be constant or whether it be monthly, ceases to be. If she manages to last to the next commissioning, the person who undresses before the physicians will be not at all like the one whom the trustees smack their lips over in the bath corridor. She has become ageless. Her shoulders stick out at sharp angles. Her breasts hang down in little dried-out sacks. Superfluous folds of skin form wrinkles on her flat buttocks. There is so little flesh above her knees that a big enough gap is opened for a sheep's head to stick through, or even a soccer ball. Her voice has become hoarse and rough, and her face is tanned by pellagra. And as a gynecologist will tell you, several months of logging will suffice for the prolapse and falling out of a more important organ. Work. The miracle worker. Nothing is ever equal, by and large, in life, and this is all the more true in camp. And not everyone had the same hopeless fate at work. And the younger they were, sometimes the easier things were for them. I could just see the sturdy 19-year-old Napolnaya, her peasant cheeks ruddy all over. In the mini-camp at the Kaluga gates, she was crane operator on the turret crane. She used to climb up like a monkey to her seat in the crane, and sometimes she would crawl out on its swinging arm without any need to, and shout to the whole construction yard, "Hi-ho!" And from the cabin she would shout back and forth with the free construction superintendent. With the foremen, she had no telephone. Everything was amusing to her, gay, as if she weren't in camp. "Go join the Komsomol." She smiled at everyone with some sort of good nature untypical of camp. She always was given 140%, the highest ration in camp, and no enemy was fearsome to her, well, other than the godfather. Her construction superintendent would not have allowed anyone to offend her. The only thing I don't know was how she managed to learn to be a crane operator. Did she get into that work without some self-interest somewhere? She was in for one of the inoffensive, non-political articles. Strength blazed out all over her. And the position she had won for herself permitted her to give her love not out of need, but from her own heart's desire. Sachkova, who was imprisoned at 19, describes her own position in the same light. She got into an agricultural penal colony, where, incidentally, there is always more to eat, and where things are therefore easier. I used to run from reaping machine to reaping machine with a song on my lips and learn to tie up sheaves. If one has no other youth but youth in camp, then one has to be gay there too, where else? And then she was taken to the tundra near Norilsk, and Norilsk too seemed like some sort of fairy tale city I had dreamed about in childhood. Having served out her term, she stayed there as a free employee. I remember I was walking in a blizzard, and all of a sudden I was seized by a mood of exaltation, and I walked along, waving my arms, fighting with the blizzard, singing the song, "The Heart is Joyful from a Gay Song." I looked at the iridescent curtain of the northern lights, threw myself down on the snow, and looked up into the sky. I wanted to sing so loudly that Norilsk could hear me, that it was not the 5 years that had conquered me, but I them, that all those barbed wires and sleeping shelves and convoys had come to an end. I wanted to love. I wanted to do something for people so there would be no more evil in the world. Well, yes, many others wanted that, too. Sachkova, nonetheless, did not manage to free us from evil. The camps still stand. But she herself had good luck. After all, not 5 years, but 5 weeks are enough to destroy both the woman and the human being. And only these two cases contrast in my investigation with thousands that were joyless or unconscionable. But of course, where else but in camp would you experience your first love if they had imprisoned you for 15 years on a political charge as an 8th grader like Nina Perigud? How could you fail to fall in love with the handsome jazz musician Vasily Kuzmin, who had not long before, out in freedom, had been adored by the whole city, and in his aura of fame and glory had seemed unattainable? And Nina wrote her verses, "A Twig of White Lilac," and he set them to music and sang them to her over the perimeter barrier separating the compounds. They had already separated them, and again he was unattainable. The girls of the Krivoshchekovo barracks also pinned flowers in their hair, a sign they had a camp marriage, but also, perhaps, that they were in love. External legislation for outside gulag seemingly abetted camp love. An all-union decree of July the 8th, 1944, on the strengthening of marriage ties, was accompanied by an unpublished decree of the Council of People's Commissars and an instruction of the People's Commissariat of Justice, dated November the 27th, 1944, in which it was stated that the court was required to dissolve unconditionally a marriage with a spouse in prison or in an insane asylum at the first indication of desire on the part of a free Soviet person, and even to encourage this by freeing such a person from the fee for issuance of a divorce decree. And at the same time, no one was obliged legally to inform the other spouse of the accomplished divorce. By this token, citizenesses and citizens were called on to abandon their imprisoned wives and husbands, all the more speedily in misfortune. And prisoners were correspondingly invited to forget about their marriages all the more thoroughly. Now it became not only silly and non-socialist, but also illicit for a woman to languish for a husband from whom she had been separated if he remained out in freedom. Zoya Yakusheva was imprisoned as a CHS family member because of her husband, and here's how it went with her. After 3 years, her husband was liberated as an important specialist, but he did not make his wife's release an obligatory condition of his own, and she had to drag out her 8 full years because of him. Yes, the Zeks were to forget about their marriages, but gulag instructions also forbade indulgence in love affairs as a diversionary action against the production plan. After all, these unscrupulous women who wandered about the work sites, forgetting their obligations to the state and the archipelago, were ready to lie down on their backs anywhere at all, on the damp ground, on wood chips, on roadstone, on slag, on iron shavings. And the plan would collapse, and the five-year plan would mark time, and there would be no prize money for the Gulag chiefs.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.